Hey guys, it's Spadoodle. You can always go to davidspade.com to look at my tour dates because I bless a lot of cities in America with my hilarious stand-up act. Or you could not go to it and get on my enemy list. Up to you.
David, whether you have a few weeks old puppy or a senior who's seen multiple decades, any dog person like me knows the most valuable thing in the world is spending time with your pet.
Yep.
The farmer's dog makes it easy to keep them healthy, which can give you more quality years with your lovely dog.
Yeah, well, I've heard farmer's dog makes and delivers fresh, healthy dog food. And, you know, that's what everyone's looking for. It's recommended by vets, nutritionally balanced. It's made from human-grade ingredients. Safe, clean kitchens, all that stuff matters.
Yeah. I mean, you love your dog. Why get the lousy food for your dog? Farmer's Dog is the best. Traditional dry and wet dog food options are extremely processed.
Sometimes
they use
dogs...
much lower quality. Yeah.
you put it in their bowl and they go, what is this kibble? And they knock it away. What is this canned goo?
Oh, yeah. I've had our dog, yeah, look at the bowl and then kind of crank its neck up and look at me. And it was like, really?
They go, really? Why don't you go first? You want a bite of this? Slop?
And it makes that sound.
Here you go, dog.
So Farmer's Dog isn't just higher quality food. They also send the food pre-portioned specifically for your dog based on their unique nutritional needs. It makes it easy to help your dog reach and stay at their ideal weight, David, and which is one of the biggest indicators of a full, healthy life. A fresh diet has been found to have all sorts of benefits, David, from healthier coat and skin, better breath, if you want to kiss your dog, and even easier digestion and smaller and better poops.
Let's look at a clip. It doesn't matter if your dog's young or old, it's always the right time to invest in their health for more happy years with your dog. Get 50% off your first box at farmersdog.com/fly.
Let the farmer's dog know we sent you. Use your code or click podcast after you sign up for your first box.
And now for a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends all before you head out the door. Your money's a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
What we have here today is Michael McKeon, and a lot of people know him. He's in so many things. I have a thing with him because we did do some SNL together. We did do a few years together, or maybe 1 year, but we talk about that. I think he clarifies that up because I'm stupider than most people. And we also did the Coneheads movie. Oh, applause. A few people in the back, remember it? The Coneheads movie, which had so many cameos in it of SNL people. You cannot even, I'm not even a SNL, just stars. We talk about that. He was on Better Call Saul, did that. He's everywhere. And of course, the headliner is he does Spinal Tap. This is Spinal Tap, if you don't know, is one of the all-time great comedies of all time. I think that's fair to say it's one of the biggies. And we do have some laughs. He's a great dude. And I had a great Conehead story for him that he did not know. And that's it. So listen in. You'll know him when you see him if you don't recognize the name right off the bat, but he's done so much more than all of us put together. Here he is, Michael McKeon. Dana, I'm going to start with Michael and I'm going to ask him a question that he gets too much because he's been in a lot of stuff. But of course, people focus way too much on Coneheads. Now, when we were in Coneheads.
I was so sure you were going to say Spinal Tap. Damn.
So nice.
We were in Coneheads together. Michael was a lovely man to work with. And it was one of my first movies. And It was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun in it because it was new. Michael had done so many things, but I think he still had a good time.
I did have a good time.
And do you remember anything from that experience other than there were a lot of celebrity cameos, if you look back?
Well, we weren't there for most of the celebrity cameos.
Right.
You know, I had mostly I had scenes with you and Dan. And once we got to the planet, we were, you know, in our underwear with the little the collars on our necks and stuff.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
It was an immigration movie that I never even picked up on that part.
No, me neither. But
we were the NSA guys.
I think it's a pretty funny movie, actually. I think some great stuff in it. And I think Dan's commission to that character was so total. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we kind of knew him from the TV sketches, but he was really that guy in so many ways, because Dan is kind of an anal retentive. I think, you know, he's really attention to detail, not in a bad way. I mean, in a very, very good way. Mm-hmm. And I just remember shooting one scene where we had just landed on the planet and he was telling his superiors, Dave Thomas and the rest of them, telling him about, so-and-so. And we shot it all morning. And we went to lunch and we came back and we continued shooting this coverage of the same scene, the same speech. And about an hour and a half in, he goes, "Oh, God damn it. Oh, God damn it. I'm not wearing the gloves. Oh, I'm not wearing the fucking gloves, Robert." And suddenly we got, oh, well, we just flushed two hours down the toilet. And he was like, he was so apologetic about it and everything. It was like, dude, okay, you know, go again. But I remember that guy, it was really, he's such a clear-eyed guy, you know? And it was a very atypical moment.
Like he wrote Dragnet, you know? Yeah.
Funniest thing in Dragnet is Kathleen, what's her name? They go to interview this woman. It's like the wife of this guy who's disappeared. Oh my God, or the landlady. Do you know what I'm talking? Kathleen Freeman. And she has one speech.
Okay.
And it's the funniest thing in the movie by such a long chalk. I look for it when I can. It's great. Anyway, I'm a living non sequitur here. You guys are trying to corral me into
not just, at all. We're just trying to get our touchstones with you. Here's one of mine very quickly. Okay.
Okay.
So like early 80s, for some reason, Billy Crystal and I had the same manager. I don't know how it happened, but I went in to meet with Rob Reiner, you, Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest, to play the drummer in Spinal Tap. Okay? You probably don't remember. But here's what happened. I came in, and I was nervous, obviously, and you guys were so comfortable with each other. And I go, this is not awkward. I'm coming here as the lone wolf, and you guys are all friends, and I have to walk in here. And so I think maybe it was you who just said, okay, let's go. So then you all immediately left the office. Everyone cleared it out and I sat in there for like a minute and then you guys came in. That's just a gag that, you know, now you're entering my world.
I don't remember
you couldn't
that.
Remember it, but that happened. No. Do you remember me in the movie? I played a mime waiter.
Oh, I remember the meeting and I remember, I thought you were coming in. I had remembered that you came in to be this tap fan who follows us around the country. That was a part that we were casting. And we thought you came across as a little intelligent, a little sophisticated, and not goony enough. So we said, let me tell you who we did cast and then not use was Eddie Deason. Ring any bells?
Okay. Oh, Eddie Deason. He was in Grease.
The Eddie Deason.
And he, when he found out that we didn't have a script and that he would have to improvise, he said, pass. So we pretty much cut the character, but you were very, very impressive. And so we said, this guy's really funny. And when we were putting together the, Billy's, the mime thing, which was something that was written in. So can he be one of the mimes? He'd be great. And so that's what we did. We did that a lot. We saw a lot of people and they didn't, you know, we were shooting blind, but we found a lot of the characters that weren't even in. Your character didn't exist until we saw you. Put it that way. That's a good thing.
Those things are memorable at that age. You know, the kind of a thing that intrigues me was the different British accents you guys did and how accurate they were. Or like Kevin Pollak and I, we did a British accent for like years whenever we see each other. We played blackjack in Tahoe and tried to trick the dealer doing some combo. Yours is very specific. Christopher's very specific and Harry.
Yeah.
But how did you come to yours, your guy? Because I've been looking at some YouTube videos of Spinal Tap and it's immaculate. Yeah.
Chris's is legitimate because he grew up, his father was British. And he spent a lot of time. It was like every summer they would go to the UK, and he knew those things. He's got a great ear anyway. So I just kind of fell into the same line as him. He would go on, and then we had a lot of time to prepare. You got to understand, when we started working on this thing, it was 1979. We didn't shoot until 82, and because we kept running out of studios. And so by the time we actually shot it, we had had a real good run at rehearsing how we sound. And Harry brought something different. Harry's, he's kind of a fictional northerner, somewhere unspecific. We always said, well, we're South London, that's kind of what we were going for. So it's just kind of getting good with it. I'm really rusty at it now.
And never breaking it. Would just do it all day, right? No, you just go in and out. But I remember when you guys walked on the set and I had not seen you in the full regalia and you were all walking around doing your accents. And it was pretty stunning. It was like, oh, there are those guys. It was pretty potent, the three of you.
You remember that we had some actual Brits on the set, or one anyway, who was, the two guys in the band, Mr. Shrimpton and Mr. Caff. Yeah. But we also had Patrick McNee, the amazing Patrick McNee.
Is he from?
From the Avengers?
Avengers?
Yeah, oh, yes.
Patrick McNee, he was, that's another.
Oh, no, wow.
The
Patrick.
He's, okay. He's eating hog, as they say.
I love all
the names.
Oh, is
he your boss or something?
Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg. He's the guy who runs the studio, yeah. So, yeah.
And who was your manager? Was he really English?
Yeah. Oh, Tony Hendra. Tony Hendra is a really interesting character. Mm-hmm. He was with the Cambridge Circus, and he and got another Englishman named Nick Ullett used to have a two-hander act. And then he worked for the Lampoon. He did a lot of the Lampoon stuff. Radio Dinner and a lot of those, the broadcasts and on the magazine. A difficult man in a lot of ways. He died about 5 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, we can talk about him.
Yeah.
I was watching it last night again. Obviously, Michael, everyone's seen it that has anything to do with comedy, and one of those ones everyone pretty much worships. I won't make you say it. I'll say it. They all worship it.
We can say it for you. The first time people improvise on film in long form was Spinal Tap. It spawned an entire industry,
potent. Obviously it's probably a combo, but you can tell scenes that go along into where you probably just bullshit for a while and take out what works, I'm guessing. But goddamn, some good stuff.
Well, Rob liked a rule of three. If you don't get it in three, and that's, three times improvising a scene, kind of knowing what worked last time and, going there. Mm-hmm. And then Rob directing the camera around a couple of different angles and so that it's cuttable. And that's kind of the way it worked. And some things we never heard, we never saw coming. And they just, when Ian says that Janine dresses like an Australian's nightmare, we just said, that's a brilliant line. No one could have written that line. It was just. You got me thinking about Tony.
I saw our boss, Fran Drescher. Do you remember that, Dana? At the beginning, Fran Drescher was PR. She was great.
Yes, mm-hmm. I do. Of course. She was Bobby Fleckman. And yeah.
once you give a character a name, then they become real. That's just got to have the name.
Right.
You know. But to this day, the one reference I always have, and David probably has, when you're playing a gig, doing stand-up, and you get lost backstage, which is more common than you think. And I go, this is Spinal Tap. We're in Spinal Tap right now.
Yep.
Happens a few times a year. That was an inspired scene as well, just because it's happened so many times. Where's the stage?
Jeff Beck told us that he did a gig with at the Apollo. It was B.B. King's 75th or whatever the thing was. And that Beck and Clapton got lost under the stage at the Apollo. And they did have that moment where they looked at each other. Well, we're in that fucking movie now. So
any story that starts with Beck and Clapton, I could listen to for a long time.
Yeah, we just saw.
Can we talk about your music? I mean, you just saw Clapton?
We saw Chris and I went to see Jeff Beck about a year ago. It was right before he died. Mm-hmm. And he played a gig here, and it was, you know, I had seen him a bunch of times, and I was old enough to be a Yardbirds fan, you know, all three of their guitarists. And so I, you know, these guys, it was amazing to see him. And he just got better and better, invented his own ways of playing the guitar. And it was pretty cool. I'll send you a cool snap of me and Chris and Jeff and Johnny Depp, who also was on the bill that night. It was kind of a cool night.
Yeah. So Beck put down the flat pick, played with his thumb, and then used his index finger to do the vibrato. And I had a brother who was a fanatic for Beck. So we were seeing Beck, me and my friends, in the 70s all the time. Beck Bogart and Carmen Appice.
Yeah, yeah.
That was Carmen an intense Appice. Trio. You know, those.
That's right.
Yeah, that was three guys going at it, you know. But with you, it's just a lane that you're in as a songwriter, a musician, and you won an Academy Award for Mighty Wind, right?
Nominated. A Kiss at the End of the Rainbow was nominated, that I wrote with Annette.
How did that song come about? Because for anyone listening who wants to look that up on YouTube, A Kiss at the End of the Rainbow, it's honestly, it's so beautiful. I mean, the melody is stunning. I mean, did you start with just guitar chords and then have Annette come in and sing the melody? How do you get a song like that? Because it's
it was kind of an assignment, because we had written Annette and I had written a song for the movie called Potatoes in the Paddy Wagon, which the new Main Street Singers do. And of course. And so Chris said, yeah, that's great. And Chris and I had been writing songs, and Eugene and Chris and I have been writing songs, and everybody individually writing. And so Chris said, you want to have a crack at this? We need a love song that maybe has a reference to a kiss in it, because it's going to be this whole thing about this couple, the Mitch and Mickey couple, and are they going to get back together again? And they had this famous kiss thing they did. So we just kind of started working on it. We wanted something that sounded like, it could have been a really old song, that it could have been from 100 years ago, or written by, you know, Tin Pan Alley folk songwriters. But it was sort of, you know, it's kind of inspired by just the simplicity of it. And so we played it for Chris, and he said, yeah, I maybe kind of wanted something that has more like a joke in it, has, you know, that's kind of a funny, this is very straight. And he really liked the song, but he said, and so Jamie heard it, his wife, Jamie. And she said, no, you're using that one. That doesn't need a joke. It has a life, and it Chris used it beautifully in the movie. And so that was great. So we work in a lot of different ways.
There's a sincerity and a sweetness to that film.
Well, I agree. You know, Chris and I are roughly the same age. And when we were 13, 14, that's when the folk thing kind of hit, and we all got guitars, and Chris got a mandolin. Actually, I didn't know him at this time, but I've known Chris since 1967, and we actually roomed together for a while,
because he's enigmatic, and in many ways. But go ahead. I just you're friends with him, so I mean, he's
good friends for a long time. He's an unusual guy, and it's kind of one of the things that's great about him is that he's exactly who he is. He's not, I don't know, he's not terribly, he doesn't go out and promote himself. You know, if he has something to sell, he'll find some way to really kind of subtly do it. He's just not that guy. He's the funniest man in the world, but you kind of got to either be on the set with him or, you know, or know him. He's just, he's a remarkable guy, very intelligent. He's got the same obsession with shitty old show business that I do, and I'm sure a lot of my friends do. Any era, really. And that was the trouble. We've been working together. The four of us have been working together. Last year, we did a lot, and then the strike happened. We had to kind of settle down. So we started working on this new project, and we figured we spent about 85% of every day just looking up the Eddie Cantor gift shop in Encino, you know, and all this shit. It's just like, it's an endless supply of old crap show business. It's just wonderful. So he shares in that, and he and I are kind of co-religionists as far as that goes. He's something.
True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. Now, you're out there, you have acres and acres, hundreds of acres. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. No. Weed control, which you hate, fertilization, aeration.
Can't stand it.
Among others. They'll do all of that, so you can do literally anything else. Dana's out there like Yellowstone. You have better things to do in your free time. I know you do. You don't want to focus on lawn care.
True Green is too good to be true, is what I'm saying. But it is true, right, David? Because you're going to have more time to do things that you want to focus on.
All the hard work, and it gets you to a great lawn. That's what you want. You take care of everything else you got to do in your life. You're very busy. Let True Green take care of this one thing. Get it off your plate.
You know what? I do have some space. I want to put some grass down. I'll call you later, True Green.
Talk to True Green. Where can listeners purchase or learn more? You go to truegreen.com. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed.
You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour.
Whoa.
They offer a satisfaction guaranteed, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. That is such a cool thing.
Good job, True Green. You're nailing it.
Are there old actors that you guys are obsessed by? Old actors like John Wayne or Errol Flynn, or like which are the ones that, because I'm obsessed with John Wayne with a friend, you know.
Yeah, I've always been a Boris Karloff guy. I always thought he was great, and I always thought he didn't get much recognition as being a really good actor, and he really was. It was just his, you know, his groove was kind of on the limited side, but he was great. I loved him.
And he played Frankenstein, right?
He was the original Frankenstein. He was the original Frankenstein monster, and he did it in Bride of Frankenstein.
He wasn't that big as a person, was he? Yeah.
He was probably 6 feet, but they jacked him up on those boots. You know, because he's immense. Yeah.
Fire back.
So I could play Frankenstein? No, here, my question for Michael was, he was on the show, SNL, we're jumping back to SNL. You were on, I think my year, I think Dana was gone, but you did one full year, and I also saw a monologue from 1985. It was really funny.
Oh yeah, with
Dana, he comes out and you're hosting and you go, I don't really do all this stuff. So I just thought, I'm not really a stand-up comedian, so I thought I would do an 18th century Scottish a cappella dirge. So he starts singing and he starts getting heckled. And
you remember who's heckling
me? Weird one that, now they didn't show it, did they?
Yeah, it's Larry David.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
I didn't see that because it went away. Yeah. Oh, because at the end he goes, hey, Hamlet, where's Squiggy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought this is such a weird one. Oh, I love it. Because I go, I thought it was Squiggy or someone. I thought, oh, who's going to be yelling? And that's great. By the way, I grew up on goddamn.
Is it true right in that era that you were offered to go in there when with Billy and those guys did their year with Martin Short, Christopher Guest? And you turned that down or at the time?
Yeah. And yeah. I had just, it just wasn't the best time to be moving to New York. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I kind of wanted to do movies more and I started doing films. I had many, many second thoughts about it. But my then wife had a child on the way. We had just bought a new house, and it was just not the time to be spending weeks and weeks.
It's not. It's a disruptive show. It's not.
No, I was a working actor. You know, I think in 1985, when I did host and we did The Folksman for the first time, which, you know, we later expanded into the Mighty Wind stuff. I think at that time, one time was really fun. And I don't know whether that season would have, there were so many people on that season. I mean, it was Billy. It was, Rich Hall. It was, it was a huge cast, you know, and Marty, rightfully so, was the breakout guy there. And, you know, but other things happened. There's a lot of angst in that season. I'm not sorry I didn't do it. And I'm glad I did when I did. It was a really interesting time. I knew in 1994 that I was being hired because Phil Hartman was leaving the show and they needed someone to play, David Spade's dad. They needed someone who was remarkably older than these hungry kids I was surrounded by.
Your Stern was very good, I remember.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
Because you know what you did with Stern, which I hadn't heard? You laugh like this.
I haven't done it in a while.
Yeah, it's a good one. I remember. Well, talked about it because, of course, he was freaked out.
It's kind of a Long Island guffaw. You know, you kind of grow up on Long Island, you get to boo. Yeah.
Yeah,
there it is.
It was kind of a new one from
who does Stern. Tom Skerritt? They say you did Tom Skerritt from Alien.
Fucking Skerritt.
I didn't.
Was he in?
Yeah, he was.
Well, You're listed as doing Adam West. I don't know. If
yeah,
it's
I did
true.
Do Adam West okay, one time.
Where I got this list.
That was the only time I was on Update.
Oh, you did on Update.
The only time I ever did Adam West. It was the only time I ever did Update. I had pitched another character who was a guy who was a kind of a spiritualist to the stars and talked about who's having sex in heaven. That was my thing.
And nice.
I made the mistake. No, it was actually pretty funny. I did it at the table and it was kind of good. But I mentioned Hume Cronin, who had been married to Jessica Tandy, who had just died. So I did a Jessica Tandy joke. And Lorne was like... Well, he was kind of too soon, but he's also... Hume Cronin's a friend of his because he's Canadian and in show business. So anyway, he told me, he says, if you haven't got a better joke, maybe we'll do it another time. So we blew it off. Anyway, whatever.
Never take that deal.
How well did you know Lorne? How well did you know Lorne when you came on in 94?
Well, I had met him in 75.
Casually?
Well, in 1975, when they were putting together the original show, I knew Chevy, and we knew Franken and Davis. And when I say we, it was the credibility gap, me and Harry Shearer and David Lander. And we were in town doing the Tomorrow Show, the Tom Snyder Show. Harry did a brilliant Tom Snyder. So we were on the Tom Snyder show doing our Tom Snyder sketch. And so around that time, they were just getting started with SNL, and we knew some of those guys. So we hung out and we kind of met all these people. I knew a lot of people who knew Lauren at the time, but I didn't work with him until Coneheads. And
welcome aboard.
That's right. Yes.
Wait, Michael, before we go on. Yeah. go ahead.
No, I was going to say my favorite thing was there is that extra mile that Lauren, I don't do a Lauren Michaels, but there's an extra mile he goes sometimes to make sure you know who you're talking to. And it's very subtle. It's very subtle. And he was always very sweet to me. And I got nothing but good stuff for him, but he did do this. I was up for another show. I had been offered a show, which was a spinoff of the Murphy Brown show. Okay. You got to stay with me. And Diane, somebody who was the creator of the Murphy Brown show.
English.
Diane English. Thank you very much. She had this new show and she wanted me to do it. And so I had an offer for that while I was, you know, talking to the SNL people. And so Lauren called me directly and he told me, he said, what about this other show? It was a messenger service show. What are you going to do about that? And I said, well, how did you know about that? And he said, Louis Malle told me. Now, Louis Malle, this French filmmaker who was married to Candy Bergen.
Who
was doing Murphy Brown. Oh. So it's like he kind of went to Europe for the killing. Yeah, Louis, it's all Louis can talk about. Is
you know, and Michael, we're not hearing good things about it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Might not be.
So I said,
I've heard it's got some problems.
I said, I want to do SNL. And he said, okay. So that was that.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/wall to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/wall. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Reality TV has hit a new high on Hulu. From executive producer Jimmy Kimmel, the all-new Hulu original series High Hopes is finally here for your viewing pleasure.
The Hulu original reality series follows two budding entrepreneur brothers and their hilarious half-baked employees at one of the fastest-growing cannabis dispensaries in Hollywood. This workplace comedy showcases the highs and even more highs of the competitive marijuana industry.
More than just coworkers, the owners and bud tenders in High Hopes are one dope family.
You'll fall in love with these quirky characters as they pursue career aspirations, love, and fame, all under a slightly hazy cloud.
All episodes of the new reality series High Hopes are now streaming only on Hulu.
Okay, so I'm jumping back to the Coneheads. We didn't finish talking about it enough for me. But what happened was there was a story that Dana doesn't even know, I don't think, where I was nervous, new movie, wearing our boxers and t-shirts we play NSA agents, Dana. I don't want to give the whole movie away, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we play NSA agents.
Yeah, don't, because I've teed it up for tonight's entertainment.
Yeah, and the Coneheads are immigrants, so we're trying to get them deported. Yeah. I don't know. I don't understand the movie, but so I just do my lines. And one day,
only Louis Malle's widow.
You know, I'm scared on this movie, and I got Michael, and Michael's great fun to work. We were a team in it. We were agents together. So, Michael, one day I'm in the trailer, and I have to wear my boxers and the t-shirt. And I said to the PA, I go, hey, man, when he came to get me, I said, don't tell anyone this, But this is so nuts. This is pure innocence. I go, I do have chicken pox, but it's covering my shirt. My shirt and boxers are covering it, so I can still do the scene. I just don't want everyone to weird out about it. And he goes, oh, cool. Hang on a second. 2 seconds later, boop, shutting down the set. Everyone go home. I was like, what's? I didn't even know what was going on. I'm like, why? What happened?
The original COVID.
God damn. Wow. Chicken pox, folks.
You didn't get it as a kid? You're in your 30s getting
late in the game.
Chicken pox?
I was 27, I think. And I had a.
Have you got your shingle shot or?
No.
It'll come back. It's dormant. We'll talk later.
No, it was so weird that I had it.
Michael and I
only...
are up to speed on that.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
I didn't really... I probably infected everyone. It was too late. But we lost a day of production.
And someone told me that
was $100,000. It's my fault.
I don't remember that. I do remember when they wouldn't let Dan's... Dan had a couple of friends on motorcycles come to hang out at the set. And they wouldn't let him in the gate because they didn't have the whatever, you know. And so they called, he's on the set, and they called him, you know, and they say, yeah, I'll say, yeah, they're okay, come in. And then they called again. He said, they won't let us in. So he tore off his head.
No.
Yes, he did. And he shut.
Whoa.
It was just like, he really, really lost it. And he went out there to the booth in his ripped off head. And berated the guard. It was a great day.
You let these Hell's Angels in right now.
Okay.
I mean, God dang.
I gotta tell you, we love Dan Aykroyd, but one thing so interesting about you is how much stuff you've done, and they just keep going. Because I dare anyone to go on YouTube, put in Lenny and Squiggy from Laverne and Shirley, and you'll see Michael McKean. And then put on Chuck McGill, the quote, worst man in the world on Better Call Saul.
Smart.
The ranges, even to you, you must look at it and go, it's pretty, yep. Well, which one is your adoring touchstone between those two?
I'm assuming I'm like Spade.
Currently Better Call Saul is pretty recent.
I'm like Spade. I do my lines.
Like the fifth?
No.
And you get out of there.
That's true. No, well, really early on, I really liked people who came on a different way for every show, everything that they did. People who had, you know, who were really, you see a lot of great entertainers are people who can be a lot of different things. Jim Carrey can be the broadest comic in the world, but he can also work real small, and he's a good dramatic actor. You know, it's just because he's clear on what he's doing. So anyway, I try and stay clear without the use of Scientology.
When they say, like on Laverne and Shirley, Michael, they go, I can't believe we have all this stinky garbage. And then, hello, you guys walk in. I was like, are they doing this on purpose? They keep walking in at the worst times. Because I was a kid. I'm like, this is... accidentally really funny that they say something horrible and then these two idiots.
Well, they were so aggressive and sudden. It was always a laugh. Like they're so sure of themselves. They would come in and just wreak havoc and then leave. There was no real, that's just broad, you know, that show really popped, as they say. I mean, it felt lively.
Well, it was.
And funny.
And we only shot it once.
Just
at a time.
One take
never,
in front of an audience?
Never, yes. And it was because it was on film. It was three cameras. And they didn't even have monitors. Mm-hmm. They didn't even have the six-pack that they do now, or the four-pack.
Oh.
It was literally the only guy who saw it. The only guy who saw it, saw something like a four-pack, was the camera coordinator. And everyone else is just these people who grew up. And they, you know, Sheldon Leonard. The guy who kind of sophisticated the three camera system after Desi Arnaz and Carl Friend invented it.
Desi Arnaz. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we were on those stages.
And so it was all based in those days on just being funny, lively, and they just knew they had it.
They
just went for the feeling of it.
Rehearse it like a play and do it like a play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the last pilot I did, never again. Was about 15 years ago, and we literally shot the first scene of the pilot 9 times in front of a studio audience. Shot it 9 times while the development people were going, I got a better one. I got a better joke here. How about he did? So you're having these mini rewrites on this thing as you go. Yeah. And by the audience never wants to fucking see you again after nine takes of that. And we shot until 2 a.m. And we wound up paying our extras for another day to sit in the audience and laugh at the stuff that we were doing for the 11th time. It's like, you can't make anything good that way. It can't be done.
Gross.
Yeah. So what
too many cooks,
No, no, it would strangle it. Horrible, horrible. Yeah.
I only did one movie without playback.
It's the worst.
And, and it was sort of, I didn't realize it was the last of, kind of the good old days. They watched it, it was in frame, and they had it, they didn't know if there's a light flare, they didn't play it back, they just said, that felt good, let's move on, and you're like, got it, and it seemed to work. And now that's almost too much going back, too much replay, too much, let's look at it again, let's look at it
Absolutely, yeah. Because everyone gets a vote, especially if it's a pilot. Everyone, you know, says, hey.
Do one for the assistant here,
Yeah. And maybe they won't let us say Jesus.
We'll
maybe
just we'll get it, Everett, we'll get.
Do a different, do an alt.
Well, I was on a show called Dream On, which was kind of a titty show on HBO. And I did a number of those.
Titty show.
Well, that's what it was.
That's why I watched it. Yeah. I didn't know. I thought I was alone. Yeah.
No, no. You probably were alone when you were watching it. Most people.
Yes, that's true.
Would you lock the door? Thank you.
leave the ice cream out there.
We used to do alternate takes, and there was one, my character had only one ball, and there was an episode about that, about his feelings of inadequacy. Because, and so I was ranting about, I said, the kids at school, they'd say, here he comes, Johnny One Nut. And that was the line that was going to go in. And they said, no, we need an alternate. So they wrote me an alternate. I looked at it and I said, that may be funnier. But I didn't tell Brian, Ben, the guy I was working with. I didn't tell him it was coming up. So we're going to do the alt take. And I said, well, here he comes, Mr. Singleton, which is arguably funnier than Johnny One Nut.
Yeah.
It's a little subtler.
He fell apart. It was a good laugh, but we couldn't use it.
Anyway. Wendy Malick on with you?
Wendy was. Greatest eyebrows in show business.
Oh, Wendy's
fantastic.
So
fantastic. Oh, she's awesome.
Boy, I agree with that. Yeah. Who is Fred Willard, just one of the funniest performers of all time?
I think.
Or don't like definitely. Him much?
No, I adore Fred.
There's something quirky about him, almost like Norm MacDonald. You can't quite put your finger on what is going on there.
Yeah.
You know it's brilliant, but it's just sort of like tilted. I remember Fernwood Tonight was the first time I got familiar with Fred Willard.
Oh man.
And it was just something about he's all the character of Fred was smiling a lot and had this, I don't know why, how it must have been fun just hanging out with that
guy.
He
was great. Well, in 1975
he probably loved you.
Yeah. In 1975 there was a group called the Ace Trucking Company. And it was Fred Willard, Billy Saluga, Mike Mislove, and George Memoli. You can find some of their stuff, not a ton of it online, but you can find some of it. And the group broke up. They still had 3 dates in the Midwest that they wanted to get if they could. So Fred and George Memoli hired me and David and Harry, who were the Credibility Gap at the time, hired us to go on the road, do some of our stuff, and learn some Ace Trucking Company stuff, and kind of make it like it's a whole act. So we were kind of in the Ace Trucking Company there for a little while. And Fred was, he's not like any other guy. He said one time, we were checking in to this hotel in Chicago, and he said to the guy, it's not near the elevator, is it? And the guy said, no, your room is not. So we're going up to the rooms, and I said, "You, why do you specify not near the elevator?" He said, oh, it's the bell. I mean, when the bell goes off, you know, when the elevator hits on the floor, I can't stand that. I have really good hearing. I can't sleep with that bell going every night. And I said, oh, that's, he says, yeah, well, sometimes if I get a room near the bell, near the elevator, I will go and disable the bell. I said, what? Yeah, I know how to do it. I travel with tools. So he has this little toolkit, and he would disable the bell, and he would hook it up again when we left in the morning. And I said, do you really do that every time? He said, one time I had to disable the one on the floor above and the floor below because I could still hear those. So well, he's a man quirky. In control of his own life. And he also had a window. He had a window on a whole nother world that we just can't see from here. He was really fucking awesome.
Yeah, that dude's a crack.
Wasn't it funny? I mean, he must have looked around almost like a Peter Sellers movie when he had the tools, like looked around the hallway to make no one, and had to get the elevator to stop to get in there. I mean, it was a James Bondian or some kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a whole leap.
Mission Impossible.
Yeah. What's the quirkiest thing about you, David Spade?
Oh, get a pen. I'm so nuts. But I think Michael got me at a pretty crazy time because SNL, I was probably losing my mind a little bit. And then I go into Coneheads, which was a little more contained. One time, Michael, we had a, why do I keep having, all I remember is Coneheads. But one time,
you were in underwear, right?
Oh,
they had chicken pox.
No, I'm running around. Obviously, I had chicken pox probably the whole year. And they said,
obviously.
They go, you have an extra scene in Coneheads where you're in a van listening. Maybe Michael wasn't in it, but it was during a show week. And they said, you have to fly back for it. So I do like read through. And then Thursday, I fly. Can I take a red eye to LA? I took a red eye somewhere. Wow. Anyway, I took a red eye because Letterman was on my flight. And he said, part of the story is, the story's long. He said, the stewardess goes, should I wake you for honey buns? And I said, no, I'm going to try to sleep. And I didn't know Letterman. And then he went to the bathroom. And when he came out, he goes, should I wake you for honey buns? I never talked in my life. And hilarious. And then I get there. I go straight to the set.
Letterman word.
Maybe, no, I think it was a 6 a.m. flight. Anyway, so I fly out there, I sleep on it, I get up, I go in, I drive out to Disney Ranch, I do this scenes, whatever, kill, get big laughs. Then I drive back to my apartment in Studio City, order a pizza, because I'm going home the next day, and I finally finish the day, and I got my hair all greased back. And then Mike Shoemaker calls me and goes, hey, Lauren wants you back. And I go, I know, I just finished shooting, I'm coming in the morning, because it was a Lauren movie. I go, I'm coming back in the morning. He goes, no, he wants you on a red eye tonight. There's a car out front. I go, shut the fuck up. I just got a pizza. So he goes, you better go. You don't. And the whole life at SNL, you don't want to get fired. So I take a few bites, get back in the car, go back to the airport. They need you at the studio at 10 a.m. So I land, I go to the studio. It's a John Goodman show. There's no one in the studio. I go, wait, no one even comes in till one. What am I fucking doing? So I just walk around. Then I go back home and no one ever mentioned it. And I'm like, wow. What's happening?
You are a Christian martyr.
Great story. We'll cut it out.
I tried to talk them out of that. I was in New York at the office. I go, don't make David come all the way back for
that. No, it was you on the phone acting like Shoemaker.
I was trying to help. David will come back, and then he'll go back. And then he'll come back again.
We'll drive him fucking crazy.
It's called a trifecta. ¿Qué pasa?
Is that what they say when you walk into sushi?
I think that's what's happening in Spanish. ¿Qué pasa? ¿Qué pasa, David Ospero?
I had a difficulty learning German in high school. It's a very tough language. I did it through textbooks and a teacher. I would have rather had Rosetta Stone.
You know, you not being able to learn German is very, very interesting.
But stupid. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program. We know this. Available on desktop as an app. Truly immerses you in the language you want to learn.
Yeah, this is planning a trip to Italy. And I think Rosetta Stone is my ticket to speak a better language.
Hey,
I want a pizza pie. But I'll be saying it in Italian. Hey, I want a pizza pie. Sounds like
that's better
English, but it's still that was.
They
Italian.
Say, do you want to sound perfectly fluent, or do you want to sound like Ratatouille?
Honestly, trusted experts for 30 years, David, with millions of users in 25 languages offered. You want to hear some?
Yeah, the
Spanish,
big ones.
French,
Oh, Spanish, French, Italiano, Sturman, Korean, Chinese, Chinese.
Careful.
Dutch, Arabic, Polish.
Fast language acquisitions, Rosetta Stone.
Should I read that straight?
It immerses you in many ways. No English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and you think in the language, Dana. That's yes. The hard part.
No, I do like their process. The intuitive process picks up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, David, because we all took Spanish in high school, and all we can say is donde está la biblioteca.
Yeah.
I can find a library, but nothing else. Rosetta Stone is a game changer.
It's like having David. A personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. We said the desktop, the app options, audio mm-hmm. companion. You can do it offline. It's amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages.
Mm-hmm.
For any and all trips and language needs in life, that's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off. That is wow. a steal. I'll say that in English, a steal.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Fly on the Wall listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
Visit rosettastone.com/fly. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/fly today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Michael McKean is humble, so I know what it's like to get compliments, but I have to say this scene that you did, because I looked it up on the stand with Chuck McGill with the electric magnet paranoia thing, and that's as good as it kind of gets, I think, for film acting. I mean, what did you think of that scene? Did you ever look at it? Did you know you were in the pocket? Did Odenkirk try to ruin takes that were really good?
It.
You know how Bob is.
That's
no, he's going too fast.
Oh, you're so good.
No, it was, I knew, I got called. I was in New York and I was doing a play in New York. No, I wasn't at this point, but I was in New York, and the director of the show, Dan Sackheim, the director of that episode, called, and he says, "You want to talk about this?" And I thought, "Oh, does that mean it's going to be hard?" And he said, "Well, have you looked at it?" And I said, "Yeah, it's a ton of stuff, and it's like a 4-page speech, basically." And he says, "Well, how do you want to shoot this?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. I mean, just what's good." I didn't kind of understand what he was asking me. He says, because it's going to be some long days. And then I realized, well, that scene is going to take like 3 days. And so it worked out, because I learned the lines, beat myself up and got the lines down. But I'm not too bad about lines. And then I knew what it was about.
And it's in that archetypal, if that's a word. Yeah, you melt down. You take yourself from being fairly together, like Captain Queeg.
It is Captain Queeg, sure.
You know, and then... And then you're losing it slowly and pacing it. So my question is, how much is technique and how much is just you're the guy and you're not really thinking, you're just being playful? Because it seems like it'd be hard to break all those moments down when they're filming. You just have to be, you just felt so in the pocket. I don't know. It's just my thing. I liked it a lot. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you very much. Thanks. No, it was a really good, it was a good show. It was a good experience. And, you know, Bob is kind of heroic. And I met Bob when we were doing SNL. And it was, I mean, he was just there occasionally. He wasn't writing on the show. But I think he was seeing Janine. Is that possible? Anyway, there were some, Tales out of school. But I think they used to go out. I don't know. But I met him a couple of times there, but I never really, really worked with him until this, until Better Call Saul. And when, you know, when they cast me in it, he called me up and he said, this is great news. We're going to have such a good time. And we did. We you know, kind of fell right into it, into this relationship. And what we did was informing, and we didn't know it, was informing the writers. And it kind of gave them a lot of inspiration. Hey, you know what could happen here? And they it helped them find a way for those characters to become, to get into a genuine conflict. Anyway, smart writers. You work with smart writers. They're wide open to everything.
Yeah.
And Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould and Tom Schnauz and Jennifer, last name, yeah, Hamilton, I think, Henderson.
that's her last name, Jennifer last name.
Jennifer last name, yeah.
Story.
Bob anyway, said one of the, maybe you can relate to this. Bob said the funniest, the hardest I've ever laughed on this podcast about SNL and stuff is that, you know people when they're younger, and Bob was just a fledgling writer in the 80s, and but we wrote a movie together called Tucson, a comedy western, stuff like that. So, and Bob is going along with his career, and then Breaking Bad comes, and then Better Call Saul. And when he came on the podcast, he goes, then he does the action movie Nobody, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Thought to himself, if this lands, because we know Bob as the fledgling writer in the 80s, at our core, he said to us, I know if this landed, you guys would be sitting at home going, what the fuck? he's an action star.
Yeah.
He's not only an Academy Award winning type actor. Now he's an action star.
Yeah.
That made me laugh so hard.
Well, if you could, do you ever play that, the time machine game where you see somebody on the screen and they're doing something kind of second rate, and you know that their career is about to take off. You want to get in a time machine and say, don't worry, this is going to be fine. you're going to get Martin Scorsese is going to put you in a movie. It's going to be amazing. And I play that game a lot. But there was a movie called, what was it called? Capricorn One. And it was about the faking of the moon landing. You could go back in time.
Yeah, O.J. Simpson.
Go back in time and you say, okay, Jim Brolin, you're going to be married to the ex-wife of Elliot Gould, who is standing right next to you in this shot. And O.J., we'll get back to you later, O.J.
Yeah.
You'll see. It'll be exciting.
What you're doing.
No one will talk about anyone but you for years.
You're going to be so famous.
Oh, yeah.
So famous.
Yeah.
Man.
All right. Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you. Unless Dana has something else to tell you, we might let you go. You've struggled with us enough. It's very nice of you.
Well, you guys are very important to me.
I love your attitude.
You're important to me because...
I'm very important to you.
Yes, because you're proof that blondes can be funny.
We all are, right?
True.
Hey. Yeah.
Three blondies.
Well, that blonde.
Blonde on blonde.
Were you a towhead as a child?
It was hard to tell because I always had a crew cut. Yeah, I was a bristly little blonde crew cut. Yeah. Pretty sad.
Me too. Hated it. Hated having a crew cut in the 60s.
Studley in that SNL monologue in 85 killed him.
You betcha. It wasn't my sweater.
Looking skinny. Good job.
I don't say this with all of our guests, but some. But what I would say to you is, what can't he do?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I can't sleep.
He will host a show. He will.
He can't sleep, Dana.
No.
It's called Ambien. Hello?
I got it. No. I'll listen.
Are you a night owl?
Yeah, half an Ambien is fine. That's what I do at night.
Yeah, not a whole one. Come on.
No, a whole one, then you got to deal with it the rest of the day.
Your mind's going like this, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
we
assume
all got that.
The creative juices. And then how do you sleep?
Yeah.
It's so hard to sleep for me because
I'm so
smart. Well,
thank you for coming on our humble show, Michael.
Listen, it's been been a lot of fun, and I had to get up anyway. So here I am. Now they're shifting our little pictures around. All right, boys.
Thank you, bud. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please follow, subscribe, leave a like, a review, all the stuff, smash that button, whatever it is, wherever you get your podcasts. Fly on the Wall is executive produced by Dana Carvey and David Spade. Jenna Weiss-Berman of Odyssey, Charlie Finan of Brillstein Entertainment, and Heather Santoro. The show's lead producer is Greg Holtzman.